to the best of the church's music for the season of Lent at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the season of Lent, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It sounds great, really. It sounds like kind of the ultimate safety net for everybody. This idea that instead of going through all these multiple insurance companies with all their various degrees of red tape, there's just one. There's just one server for everybody. And it's called, nowadays, it's usually being called Medicare for All. It sounds like a great idea. And what could possibly go wrong? Does there exist any kind of concern about freedom of conscience when it comes to having one massive provider that everyone must go through? And what if you can't or aren't allowed to go through, especially if you're a doctor and your livelihood might depend upon that provider? Joining us to talk about two issues, Medicare for All and the freedom of conscience, and a little bit later, transhumanism, Wesley Smith, senior fellow at the Discovery Institute Center on Human Exceptionalism, author of several books, including Culture of Death, The Age of Duharm Medicine. He's also a columnist for National Review Online. Wesley, welcome back.
Thanks, and I'll be seeing you in June.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it, in fact. The idea, Medicare for all of that sounds good. I mean, it sounds like it's universal, and it sounds like it's a big safety net that everyone may need at some time or the other. What could possibly go wrong?
Well, they called it Medicare for All for a reason, because the Medicare program itself is popular, which, of course, is the health insurance for people age 65 and over and a few others. But I read this 120-page bill, and it's nothing like your grandmother's Medicare. This is an authoritarian, single-payer health care plan, more like Medicaid than Medicare, that would destroy private health insurance. It would destroy the current Medicare system for elderly people. It would intentionally take all profit out of health care. It would allow the government to steal pharmaceutical companies' patents if they did not agree to sell a medicine for the amount of money that the government demanded. And it would force every single doctor who wanted to practice medicine and receive fees from the single-payer system to become a government contractor, because they'd all have to sign what are called participation agreements. And these participation agreements really leave the doctors have no ability to negotiate. It's what's known in the law as a contract of adhesion. It's a take it or leave it deal. And part of the take it or leave it deal would require doctors to give up their right to religious freedom. That is, they would have to perform services to which they had a religious objection, because not doing so would be considered discrimination under the participation agreement. And if you discriminate under the participation agreement, you can be kicked out of the participation agreement, and then you can't earn a living.
So is there any view toward exceptions for conscience?
Not if you are a participating provider. The only way you could potentially get out of it is if you do not sign a participation agreement and become a strictly cash and carry kind of doctor. That would be very, very difficult, because if you can, that would mean you cannot take any patients that are beneficiaries under the government plan. So that means you would be restricted to only those patients who could have a cash basis for you, which I suppose could work for, a minority concierge practice for very wealthy people. But there aren't going to be that many opportunities for those kinds of practices. So for most doctors, it's either, if this became law, it would be either sign the participation agreement and give up your conscience rights, among other things, or become a cosmetic surgeon, I guess, which would not probably be part of the government program, meaning, for beauty things, not for reconstructive, or find a way to be part of a concierge service that does not take any government benefits of any kind. So it would have to be a cash and carry kind of operation. So for most doctors, the answer is no.
So I'm thinking about, mutual acquaintance of ours, you're acquainted with Rod Dreher, aren't you?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you know, he's talked often about the Benedict option. And when I read your article on freedom of conscience and Medicare for all, the first thing I said to my boss was, this just makes the case for the Benedict option. We're going to need whole hospitals full of doctors who are willing to buck the system if this were actually put in place.
And it's going to be almost impossible, because the whole point of the way this law has been written, and it's been co-sponsored by 107 House Democrats, that's almost half the caucus, it has been written to make it so that you cannot escape, as Rod has suggested, by creating your own institutions. The only way, hospitals will also have to sign participation agreements. And the only way they would be able to completely escape is if they did not accept any government healthcare. And I don't know of any hospital that could do that. Even nursing homes and elderly centers, because the Medicare for All bill, unlike current Medicare, covers long-term care. So you could end up in a situation where assisted suicide is allowed and provided as a government benefit under the law, and a Christian, let's say, nursing home doesn't want to permit assisted suicide on premises, it might have to stop being a participating provider, which means it might go out of business. I mean, this is really, these participation agreements, which haven't gotten much coverage in the media because nobody's read the 120-page bill. I did. Most people think, oh, it's going to be like Medicare is today. It's not anything like Medicare is today. Today, a Medicare doctor doesn't have to accept payment in full for the Medicare fee. The Medicare doctor, if he's a part of the, agrees to accept what's called the assignment, he will accept the amount of money Medicare pays as his entire fee, and then part of that would come from Medicare and part would come from the patient. If he doesn't accept the assignment, he can charge, I think it's 15% more than the Medicare fee, and receive the difference from the patient. But he's not required to sign a participation agreement that handcuffs him to do whatever Medicare says in terms of what a patient wants, otherwise it's discrimination. There's no participation agreement in Medicare today of the kind that is in this bill. It's not Medicare. That's what I have to tell people. People, oh, it's Medicare for, it's not Medicare. It's not Medicare for the patient, and it's not Medicare for the doctors, and it's not Medicare for the hospitals. It's just called Medicare for All, so people will like it.
Okay, I don't want to get conspiratorial here, but other than perhaps a sincere, well-meaning desire to see universal health care, why is this kind of idea being pushed legislatively?
Part of it is what you just described. You have people who ideologically believe that socialized, and this is socialized medicine, I mean, government not as employees, but as contractors of the government, because that's what a participation agreement would be, they believe that this is the best approach. But they all, there's also an ideological belief that gets dovetailed into this, that, and we saw it with the Affordable Care Act as well. When you centralize healthcare into the federal government, then you have the ability to use that power given to you by the centralization to affect social change that you think is desirable. So in this Medicare for All bill, the Hyde Amendment is destroyed. What is the Hyde Amendment? The Hyde Amendment says there cannot be government funding for abortion. That's one of the rare comity areas that we have in this country around that contentious issue. The Medicare for All bill says that the trust fund, I don't mean to be technical, but that's the, from where the money would come, must pay for abortion. So there, that kills Hyde. And it says in terms of medical conscience, specifically that you cannot discriminate based on a woman's pregnancy, and it includes abortion in the specifically by name, in the non-discrimination clause. So doctors who are OBGYNs, for example, if they're asked for an abortion, if this were the law and they were a participating provider, meaning they were a government contractor, they would have to provide the abortion. If they were a podiatrist and the woman asked for an abortion, they would not, because that would be beyond their normal area of healthcare or area of practice.
So I see this as having not only the effect that you described before, but in the case of OBGYNs, I see this driving doctors of conscience on the issue of abortion not only out of the field, I see it essentially telling anybody who's pro-life and against abortion, don't even bother becoming an OBGYN.
Right. That's correct. And I've written for several years now, there is an attempt to drive pro-lifers out of healthcare altogether. Because the thing that it's not that they can't find abortions, it's they don't like the message. When a doctor says, no, I won't do this, this is wrong, that is the message that is objectionable. You see the same thing regarding in terms of like in Canada with euthanasia, lethal injections. The province of Ontario has told doctors if they are approached by a qualified patient to be killed, they must kill that patient or they must find a doctor who will. It's called an effective referral. You see in bioethics journal after medical journal, including the New England Journal of Medicine, the Journal of Medical Ethics and others. These are very mainstream, high profile, influential medical journals, article after article saying the doctor should not have the right to say no to things to which they have a religious objection or moral objection if the request is legal. You're going to see it also, I think, occurring in the areas of gender dysphoria, where because and certainly in the Medicare for All Act of 2019, there's a specific provision that doctors who are participating providers cannot discriminate based on gender identity. In other words, gender dysphoria. So if a male came to the doctor, biological male, who identified as female, and that biological male came to a doctor who would deal with such issues, saying that they wanted the treatments that would allow them to change their sex, if a doctor said no, that could be deemed discrimination, and it could cost them their participation agreement, which would cost them the ability to earn a living. So this is a hard-fisted centralizing of the system that not only focuses the – and that also will allow healthcare rationing, by the way, because you're going to have these cost-effectiveness boards. And all of that will be done by regulation. I'm just talking what's in the bill here. You still have the ability of regulators to put other stuff in there that isn't in the bill because the bill is chock full of the secretary will decide this, the secretary will decide that, which means the Secretary of Health and Human Services. And that means regulators who pass these regulations where there really is no direct participation other than through comments that people can make. But there's no legislative participation in that. And they basically said, but it's in the bill that you cannot discriminate based on gender identity, based on sexual identity and so forth. And so, you know, of course, we don't want doctors discriminating, for example, based on race or something of that sort. We don't want doctors saying, I'm not going to treat somebody for an infection because they're gay. But it would also apply to you're going to have to change the sex of a transgendered person. It might mean that a doctor who does not want to inhibit the puberty of a child heading towards adolescence, which is happening now for children with gender dysphoria. I posted a piece the other day. They're now doing mastectomies on 14-year-olds who are gender dysphoric, who identify as males. And I mean, can you imagine if it would be considered discrimination for a doctor to say, no, I'm not going to cut off the healthy breasts of a teenage girl because she identifies as a boy, because it causes her harm, and because I don't believe that this is a... You could end up losing your ability to earn a living as a physician. Because everything is lockstepped into this participation agreement and into the centralized power of the regulators and the bureaucrats and the bioethicists that would be in charge of the system at the federal level.
Well, we should point out, since you mentioned the Secretary of Health and Human Services, not only does the bill appear to offer no legislative participation, as you say, but the Secretary of HHS is not elected. That's an appointed position. And it sounds like much would ride upon the regular policy would ride upon who the president of the United States happens.
Right, because the president will appoint the HHS secretary. But there's also who's in the bureaucracy, because the people who are in the bureaucracy, sometimes you hear people talk about the administrative state, you hear people talk about the deep state, you hear people talk about the swamp. The administrative state has tremendous power, because what the Congress does today with almost all bills is they'll pass a general framework. Think of this as a skeleton. And then they will say, well, this detail, the secretary of, you know, it's not just healthcare. We're talking about all the various subjects that the government has control over. The secretary will decide this. The secretary will decide that. And so that goes into the administrative process, which is called a regulation or promulgating a regulation. And a regulation is promulgated generally in the following fashion. They'll put out a notice of potential rulemaking, and they'll publish it in the Federal Register. How many of your listeners read the Federal Register? Not very many. There are thousands and thousands and thousands of pages every year in the Federal Register. How many of these things are actually reported in the popular media? Unless it's, for example, the Trump administration saying we want to protect medical conscience, which set the New York Times hair on fire, the answer is not very much. So you do this notice of proposed rulemaking. The people who read the Federal Register are the K Street lobbyists. I'm in D.C. now, so I know exactly where all this takes place. The K Street lobbyists, the nonprofit organizations, the advocacy groups, they scour the Federal Register for things that are relevant to their area of advocacy. They will then make sure that comments are brought in, because you have like a 6-month period for comment, and anybody can send a comment. An organization can send in a comment, an individual can send in a comment. And then the bureaucrats go through all the comments to see what people think about this notice of proposed rulemaking. Sometimes they will make some alterations based on those comments. Eventually, the rule will come to either not be promulgated, which is rare, or it'll be promulgated with some changes, and then that becomes the final rule. That rule then is published in the Federal Register, and it becomes binding law along with the statute itself, because what it is doing is it is adding the flesh and blood and face to the body of the law, where the statute itself only provided the skeleton. The first time I realized this, I wrote a book many years ago with Ralph Nader on aviation safety. And I was back here in D.C. This would have been in the early 90s, probably 92. And I was so stunned at how little power the Congress actually exerted over this field and how much of the power was in the administrative state or in the bureaucracy. Well, that's even more true today. And that's basically what it is. So this, if you would pass this law, this Medicare for All Act of 2019, which is 120 pages, it could end up with 10,000 pages of regulations. And those regulations would probably, depending, as you said, who's the HHS secretary, even potentially more onerous than the law. And also you then have the permanent bureaucrats who cannot be, who are there, they never can be moved or fired. And many of them are ideological, too. A lot of conservatives complain that the Obama administration filled the bureaucracy not with professional-type people who were, you know, they're supposed to be dispassionate on ideology and on partisanship, but that the complaint is that they put in a lot of partisans into this permanent civil service, and those people are there now kind of thwarting any kind of conservative efforts by President Trump. I'm not going to make a comment on that, but that's the situation. That's why it's called the swamp. The bureaucracy is an entity and a power almost unto itself.
Wesley Smith is our guest. He's senior fellow at the Discovery Institute Center on Human Exceptionalism. We're talking about two issues, Medicare for All and freedom of conscience. And then when we come back from the break, we'll turn to something he's written recently about transhumanism. He says it's the lazy way to human improvement. We'll find out why after this.
I'm going to talk about two big trends in American life over the last 50 or 60 years, the decline of institutional Christianity and the growing polarization of our politics.
Ross Douthat of the New York Times talking about his presentation at the 2019 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
the increasingly strident division between an ideological left and an ideological right. And I'm going to argue that Christianity has weakened precisely because people have become more likely to identify with ideologies than with religious beliefs, and that a recovered Christianity, a more robust public religious faith, is actually an answer to polarization because it gives people an identity that's bigger than partisanship, so they can define themselves as Christians first and liberals or conservatives second.
You can meet and hear Ross Douthat at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 7th and 8th in Chicago. Learn more at issuesetc.org.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Looking for a foreign language program that will revolutionize your students' vocabulary knowledge and their understanding of grammar? How about a program that teaches critical thinking skills, too? Look no further than Memoria Press's Latin curriculum. Students of all ages can use these Latin study programs. Give your students the gift of Latin today. To order, visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR9. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Hey, Todd, what have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore, thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority. They've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. Thecleaningauthority.com.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We talk humanism and human improvement with Wesley Smith here for the next few minutes of the program. He's senior fellow at the Discovery Institute Center on Human Exceptionalism, author of several books, including Culture of Death, The Age of Do-Harm Medicine, and a columnist for National Review Online. You can meet and hear Wesley making the case for the Hippocratic Oath at the one and only 2019 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 7th and 8th in Chicago. Early bird registration is $115 and includes three meals. Thanks to the Lutheran Church Extension Fund sponsorship, childcare is absolutely free for ages 1 through 12. Find out more and register at issuesetc.org or make your $115 check payable to Issues Etc. and send it along with your downloadable registration form to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Making the Case Friday, June 7th and Saturday, June 8th at Concordia University, Chicago. Wesley, refresh our memory. What is transhumanism?
Transhumanism is a futuristic social movement. I would call it a neo-religion because it is materialistic, and it seeks to create a post-human species using biotech, cybertech, robotics, any other kind of tech. And there are two main goals of the movement. The first is immortality. It seeks to be able to live forever in the material world. It even has an eschatology. A new Jerusalem will occur. That's not their term. I'm using the terminology because your listeners will understand the reference. But they call it the singularity. And the singularity is when the technology achieves a state of such complexity and control that it will not be able to be stopped, and it will basically lead to a transformed world where we can upload our minds into computers and live forever in the software, or we can blend our consciousnesses with others who do so, or we can freeze our brains and then be brought back and have new bodies, or we can repeatedly clone ourselves and keep moving our brains into other bodies and so forth. There are different mechanisms, but the hope for them, because they're materialists and materialists in the end have no hope. If all you think that exists are carbon molecules, there's no hope in that. And so the hope they're seeking, and they're attracting quite very well-off people. Ray Kurzweil, just for example, of Google, billions and millions of dollars are being poured into this movement. Their hope is that they will be able to defeat death. The second thing they want to do is be able to turn themselves into these extraordinary kind of superhero type capacities, as I put it, without having to do any work to be extraordinary. They want it to be done through brain implants to increase their intelligence, through genetic engineering of embryos so that they can increase, you know, refashion their progeny to be what they want them to be. It's kind of a neo-slavery for progeny, because you are basically being designed to fit the desires of your parents instead of being brought forth in unconditional love, which I know is an ideal, but that's the idea of parenthood. And so you have this futuristic movement that has become all the rage in Silicon Valley, comes out of the High Academy, and the idea again is to try to create a post-human species that can bring about immortality, the fountain of youth, and superpowers based on technical interventions.
So, two things. You have been accused, when you've written about this on several occasions, of fear-mongering. What's your response?
I'm glad you brought that up, because in this latest piece I wrote in National Review, I wrote it because I was attacked in an article in a magazine called Arrow, and it's called Transhumanism and the Death of Human Exceptionalism. And it quotes me saying that transhumanism is eugenics. It's a new form of eugenics, which, of course, is the idea of creating a better human species. It led to terrible evil from, say, 1908 through the end of World War II. He says Wesley is, quote, clearly fear-mongering, and then he says, but this depiction, what I've described, is fairly accurate. Excuse me for laughing here. But I love it when they say Wesley Smith is fear-mongering, but what he says is true. Well, if what I say is true, how is that fear-mongering? What he's really saying is, I don't agree with his opinion that this is an unhealthy thing to do. That's where the real disagreement is. Wesley believes that transhumanism is profoundly unhealthy, it's very sad, and it is a form of eugenics. The values of transhumanism destroy human exceptionalism, human equality, and they believe that being a natural person is inadequate because we're all going to die. And so it reminds me of the old Woody Allen joke. A woman in the Catskills meets her friend, and Agnes says to Edith, I went to the new restaurant last night. And Edith says, how was it? And Agnes says, the food was terrible and such small portions. Which I think is a very funny joke. So transhumanism says human life is just so inadequate. We're not strong enough. We're not smart enough. And we die too soon. It's really a sad kind of awkward movement, but it's dangerous in the sense of the values it's promoting. It's dangerous because it says that some people have greater value than other people. It's dangerous, I think, because it has the potential, and may already be, of diverting a lot of research dollars away from areas that could do a lot of good into this quixotic quest for human immortality. And it shows a terror of death that I don't think is healthy, because if one of the things I believe, you know, and I'm a Christian, one of the things I believe is that we should remember our death, because it helps us live better lives. It helps us focus on what is important in this life. And you don't have to be a Christian to understand that, certainly by any stretch. And you don't even have to be religious to understand that. But there is a natural cycle to life, a time to be born and a time to die. And sometimes I've heard that called a parenthesis in eternity. When we're in that parenthesis, we should make the most of it. And the one thing that that I continually criticize transhumanism for is they never talk about love. You know, they want to increase intelligence. They want to increase body strength. They want to look like a cat, whatever it might be. They never talk about love. But the problem is there's no pill to increase love. There's no brain implant that can increase love. Love is a virtue. It has to be pursued. It has to be pursued in the way we treat each other. It has to be pursued in the way we attain humility and selflessness and treating others as we would want to be treated. That's a virtue. Transhumanism isn't about virtue. Transhumanism is about modifications without effort that supposedly would make us better, but they wouldn't, because I don't care how smart we are. I don't care how capable, if we could jump across a 20-foot wall, if we don't have love, we don't have anything. I think that when people are putting their desires into this kind of hopeless quest, which, you know, humankind has always been involved in, the fountain of youth and all that, then I think they're going, these people are going to miss out on some of the, what's really important in life, and that's love.
Wesley Smith is Senior Fellow at the Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism. He is author of several books, including Culture of Death, The Age of Due Harm Medicine. He's a columnist for National Review Online. You could read his columns and purchase Culture of Death at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Wesley, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, and I look forward to seeing you in June.
Speaking of love, when we come back from the break, we're going to be studying the Lenten hymn, My Song is Love Unknown. Dr. Arthur Just will be our guest. It's the ultimate hubris, isn't it? We've often heard guests here on this program remind us that water never rises above its own source. To suppose that we, humans, can somehow improve upon ourselves apart in a purely materialistic way is the ultimate in human pride. That we can achieve something higher than we are ourselves is the ultimate in this kind of hubris, and that we can do it with technology that we ourselves have invented, that somehow putting those together, the sum will be greater than its parts. It's not only pride, hubris, it's also foolishness. When we come back, we'll be in the Lenten hymn, My Song is Love Unknown. Dr. Arthur Just will be our guest.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Do you dread going to work out?
Performance Fitness in Edwardsville offers a fun, supportive, tight-knit community and environment. Visit them on the web at performancefitness618.com or call 618-692-5063. Performance Fitness is the facility in the St. Louis Metro East where the focus is on member results, not membership numbers. 618-692-5063 or performancefitness618.com. Performance Fitness of Edwardsville.
In a world awash with all sorts of information, opinions, and ideas, there is still a place where God's Word is the central and only focus. Messiah Lutheran Church, 801 North Madison, Lebanon, Illinois. At 9 o'clock on Sunday mornings, God's people gather there to listen to Him. There you will find His words of law and gospel, and of course, our Lord's Holy Supper. Bible classes focus on the Bible and the Lutheran confessions. Come, listen, believe, and live, and check out our website at messiahlebanon.org.